You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Hey guys, it's Ken Davenport. Hear that music in the background? You know what that is? That is the brand new Daddy Long Legs cast recording, which just was released digitally. For those of you technologically confused, that means iTunes. So go get it. It's fantastic. Megan McGinnis, Paul Nolan, they sound stunning. Go get it today. And now on to the podcast.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I am Ken Davenport, and today, okay, look, I'm just going to say it. We're talking to one of the most successful director and choreographers in the business, both artistically and commercially. That's right, people. I'm thrilled to be chatting here today with five-time Tony Award winner Susan Stroman. Welcome, Stro.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy to be here.
You can go on PlayBillVault.com to see all the credits, but we're talking big blockbusters like Crazy for You, Showboat, The Producers, hello, Young Frankenstein, Scottsboro Boys, Big Fish, Bullets Over Broadway, just a few of the long list of credits of Stroh's, and I'm not going to list them all again because it would take about 18 hours to get through them all, so we'll just get to the good stuff. How did you get started in the theater? Where did it begin?
Oh, my. Well, I have to say I have been in a dancing school since I was about 5 years old, and my father was a wonderful piano player, so I was that little kid that would dance around the living room to her father playing the piano. And I've always been in a dancing school my whole life, and it's because of my mother and father. They really admired music and felt it was important in one's life. And it was really being completely passionate about music and about my father's piano playing, really. So I would start to create dances even at an early age because I would hear his music and begin to dance. So choreographing has been a very natural part of my life since I was a little girl.
And where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. I know, and I went to the University of Delaware, so I'm a Delaware gal through and through. And being in Delaware, that means you're close to Philadelphia, of course, and so I grew up doing community theater in the Delaware area and the Philadelphia area. So and as much as I loved dance, I loved theater even more, and I think it was... I studied ballet and tap and jazz, and although I loved all three, it was dance and the theater and storytelling that I loved the most. So my trajectory, instead of taking me to choreograph for ballet companies or modern dance companies, I really wanted to go into the theater because it was all about storytelling.
Do you remember the first big show you saw, first big Broadway show or touring show you saw?
I remember very clearly. There's a wonderful, beautiful playhouse in Delaware, in Wilmington, Delaware, at the Hotel DuPont. And I would try to go there as much as possible. And it was a big deal to get downtown Wilmington. My parents didn't want me to go downtown Wilmington. But one time without their knowing, I went down and I got a front row ticket for a touring company of Seesaw. And I sat there, and out came this tall drink of water called Tommy Tune, tap dancing in clogs and girls in balloons and you know, Gittle Moscow and a story about a girl in New York. And I thought, this is for me. I really wanted to do this. It just was one of those shows that stuck with me.
How old were you then?
Well, I would be in the last year of high school, probably.
So apart from the dances you created in your living room to your dad's piano playing, what was the first thing that you actually choreographed, the first show?
Oh, well, let's see. It would have been in community theater, I suppose. It would have been Applause in community theater.
In community theater.
Yes.
Again, high school age, college age?
High school age,
high school age. So you were choreographing back then.
Yes, definitely. I even choreographed the halftime shows in high school band. Yes, I was choreographing at a very young age and creating.
So how do you create? I think, you know, everyone out there probably knows, oh, a book writer for a musical sits down at a keyboard and types. A musician or a composer may sit down at a piano and play. But I think the choreographic process is probably the biggest mystery of them all.
I think so.
So what do you do?
Well, ever since I was little, I would visualize music. And still to this day, I visualize music. When I hear it, whether it's an old standard or rock and roll or classical piece, I imagine all these people dancing and stages and costumes, the whole thing. So music isn't really a relaxing element in my life because my brain starts to spin. And I think the first thing I do when I do a show is really listen to the music over and over. And then a lot of it is arranging the music to enhance and support the choreography. That's another thing. At a very early age, I was inspired by watching Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies, and it was a big deal when they came on television. And I could see how, when Fred Astaire would dance, the orchestra completely supported his movement. And I understood that at an early age, too, how if Fred Astaire jumped in the air, so did the orchestra. So arranging for the dance is also a big part of what I do when I create a new piece. And I work with the composer and I work with the dance arranger, but it all is one. And I'm very much part of even the time signature. It tells story. For example, in Crazy for You, Bobby and Polly, if I want them to be coy and shy with each other, they can play, Shall We Dance, like a soft shoe rhythm. If I want them to be fall in love, of course, we play it in 3/4 time. If I want them to chase each other, we do it in a fast two. So even time signature in a melody can help you tell story and elicit emotion from the audience.
And how much musical training do you have in that? I mean, it seems like a choreographer really has to understand
that. Well, I think so. I think you have to really understand music. I took piano and guitar when I was little, but now it's all about the dance for me, and it comes quite naturally to work musically with people.
So you are at the University of Delaware.
Yes.
You've got this long list of halftime show credits and applause at the community theater. How do you jump from there to New York City and start to work professionally? How did that happen?
Well, I was sort of a big fish in a little pond there in that area, doing a lot of the shows and in all the different community theaters. And at that time, there were dinner theaters in that area. And one day, I had a friend that said, let's go to New York and audition for something called the Goodspeed Opera House. And I just went along, not really knowing what I was getting into. And I walked in, and there seemed to be like 400 girls in this one room, which I couldn't believe. And we were all auditioning for the Goodspeed Opera House for a show called Hit the Deck. And they were going to cast the whole thing that day, and out of all those girls, they picked two girls who were non-equity, and one of those girls was me. And all of a sudden, I got a call saying, you know, this is when you start up the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut, and you're getting an equity card. And I didn't know what really an equity card was. I sold my car, I told my parents goodbye, and all of a sudden, I was in the business. And I'll never forget the first day of rehearsal, when one of the cast members named Hal Shane sat next to me and said, "So, how long have you been in the business?" And I said, 5 minutes. And so then that was it. And, you know, I did that, did Good Speed, and then started to audition and did the national tour of Chicago. I was the Hunyak. And that was with Gwen Verdon and Cheetah Rivera and Jerry Orbach, and took acting lessons from Jerry Orbach while I was on the road. And it was sort of a whirlwind when I got started. However, the whole time I was performing, I was thinking I needed to be on the other side of the table. Although I came to New York as a song and dance gal because I could sing and dance, it wasn't what I wanted. I wanted to create for the theater. I wanted to be a creator. And so I started to choreograph and direct small things like industrial shows, club acts, commercials, anything I could to be on that side. And it made me very happy. Happier than performing. So I know in New York you can't really have a split focus. You have to choose one thing, and that's it. To have a split focus, people don't believe in you if you want to do a million things. You have to have a split focus, at least at that time. Maybe it's different today. But so I decided to not be seen any longer as a performer and just take my chances. And I was in performing in a show called Musical Chairs. It lasted maybe 2 weeks on Broadway. But another fellow was in that show with me named Scott Ellis. And we were lamenting one day about how we wanted to be a director and choreographer and not be in a show. And so we decided, Scott had done The Rink with Candor Neb and I had done Chicago. And we thought, well, what if we asked them if we could take one of their shows and take it off Broadway? And we decided we would ask them about Flora the Red Menace, and maybe we could do a small version of it. And the worst thing that could happen would be that they would say no. So we got brave and went and asked them, and they said yes. We couldn't believe it. They said yes. So then we had to find a place to do it, so we went down to the Vineyard Theater and pitched our idea about doing it as in the form of WPA theater, and they said yes, so all of a sudden we were doing this Candor Neb show off Broadway. We couldn't believe it. It was wonderful. And I think we made, you know, about $200 for the entire summer. But everyone saw it, had a little bit of a cult following. So that launched our careers. We became best friends with Candor Neb, and still to this day, I just saw John Candor today. You know, we have remained friends after all these years, and we created And the World Goes Round with them, and we did Steel Pier with them, and then, of course, I went on to do Scottsboro Boys with them. And then Hal saw it, Hal Prince saw it, and yeah, I ended up doing Don Giovanni with Hal and then Showboat with Hal. And today I'm doing Prince of Broadway with Hal. So he became a good friend, and Liza saw it, and I ended up doing Liza's big show at Radio City Music Hall. So taking a chance and knocking on Candor Neb's door really launched our careers, and I never went back on the stage.
Do you remember your work in Flora the Red Menace back then?
Yes.
Remember?
Yes, I do remember, because there was, I think that I had a montage in there, you know, where Flora lived with all these artists in a big loft, and a montage came together about all the things that they did as artists. And I think that was the thing that Hal thought I would be good for like Showboat, because there are big montages in Showboat. And yes, I mean, it was great to, and actually I think Candor Neb really enjoyed working in a small venue also and having another shot at that show.
So that montage you talk about, and for those of you who don't know, I was the associate company manager on that production of Showboat, so I used to do Susan's house seats all the time. That montage was such a brilliant passage of time in that piece. It was so wonderful. And you, look, you have these iconic numbers when I think about Slap That Bass in Crazy For You, the Little Old Lady number in The Producers. So many of these iconic numbers. What's your favorite? If the Smithsonian was putting one of your numbers into the Institute, which one would you want them to put in there?
Well, it is hard to pick. I try to, or not even try to, but I feel like in every show, it's wonderful to, if you can create an image in that show that goes with that show that an audience will remember. And like the girl in the yellow dress or the walkers, or, you know, there's something in every show that you want people to remember and something that they've never seen before. So I'm not sure. I think, there's so,
there are a lot of them.
There
to
are
choose
a lot
from.
Of images. Yeah, there are a lot of images. It might be in Crazy for You, there was a moment where the girls came from New York City to Dead Rock, Nevada, and Robin Wagner, who's this wonderful set designer, gave me 10 treadmills upstage, and the girls would just walk, and they hooked arms and walked, and a sunset rose, and this town came in. So as they walked, Robin would then bring the town in really slowly. And I remember thinking that was a very cool image, you know, but... And, you know, there's so many, I love collaborating with my set designers, even in Bullets Over Broadway. Santo, the last scene where the gangsters are chasing Cheech, Santo gave me a theater that just spun on a turntable, and I was able to choreograph gangsters chasing each other on that, and that's something I had never done before, and it was amazing to be able to do that. So I do love collaborating with set designers. It's one of my favorite things.
It's actually something I've never even thought of before, how the choreography and the set design are very interwoven.
Well, yes, I think the more you know about the other designer's job and their art, the better off your own work is going to be. I could make the most fantastic dance step, but if it's the costume's not right, it won't matter. Or I could do the most fantastic dance step, and if it's not lit right, it won't matter. So you all have to come together and collaborate, and that makes everyone's work better.
So I'm sure if I asked you to describe Fosse's style or Bennett's style, you could probably give me a description. Describe your style.
Well, I think it's very much in character. I really don't think I have a style that is like Fosse's, because Fosse's like Picasso. You know, he has a style and he sticks to it. Boom. And but I think mine is more about, I would change it up. I like to change things up. So it's more about the characters. I always want to make it believable when a character launches into song and dance. And so in creating these pieces, I even become these characters while I'm working it out. So Max Bialystock would dance very differently from Leo Bloom. And you know, you work these things out through motivation and character. I do have a lot of rhythm. Even in my lyrical work, it's very rhythmic. So I think rhythm might be a big characteristic that is through all the choreography. And even in a ballad or even in a lyrical moment, it's still rhythmic.
So tell me about how you transition from being a choreographer to then being a director, and how that was for you.
Well, it was quite natural, because when you are a choreographer for the theater, you really can only dance in character, and you're always telling a story and pushing the plot forward. So it was quite natural. My first Broadway show to direct and choreograph was The Music Man, and that was a perfect show for me personally, because it was about a town that started, you know, in Iowa, everybody was stiff and they didn't move and stuck up. And then by the end of the show, everyone's doing the shapoopee and playing the trombone. So it had a real arc. It had a real journey through movement. And it was about a music man, who believed in music and had a think method and, you know, and had a famous phrase of, I always think there's a band, kid. So that show was perfect for me to put both elements into, because I feel like I knew every character in The Music Man. Those people had crossed my life. And then, of course, it was all about music and dance. And then, you know, contact really came from, I happened to be in a club down in the meatpacking district at 1 a.m, as you do. And I was in this club, and in walked a girl in a yellow dress, and she would step forward when she wanted to dance with someone, and then she would retreat back when she was finished with them. And I thought, a girl in a yellow dress, because of course everyone was dressed in black, like good New Yorkers. But I got obsessed watching her. And I thought, well, she's going to change some man's life tonight. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call from Andre Bishop at Lincoln Center, and he had seen Steel Pier, and he liked what he had seen. And he said to me, if you have an idea, we will help you develop it. And I thought, you know, I do have an idea. And I thought, let me put together a show about this girl in the yellow dress that I saw. And I called my good friend John Weidman, and we sat around, and Andre and Bernie Gersten gave me like 18 dancers in their basement at Lincoln Center, where they have beautiful studios. And they gave me like 4 weeks to work something out, and left me alone. And then they came down and they saw Contact, and they said, okay, we have to produce this. And it ended up running for about 3.5 years at the Lincoln Center. It's their longest running show.
It was a beautiful production.
Well,
as well. And I can't help but think of your earlier comment now. You started to talk about The Music Man, and instantly in my mind, this iconic image from The Music Man came, which was the, of course, the curtain call, when you put the entire cast playing, you know, trombones and the American flag at the end.
Yes.
I mean, there are these incredible images in what you do that are huge takeaways that I've never thought of before.
Yes, I've actually had a lot of people talk about that curtain call still to this day. I did a talk up at the Y, and some older gentleman raised his hand, and he said that was the greatest thing he's ever seen. And I thought that was so lovely because it was the curtain call. But, you know, it was one of those. When I read a novel, sometimes I'll close the novel and I always wonder what those people are doing. And after going through the script of The Music Man, I closed the script and I thought, well, what are those people doing? And I thought, but you know, they're probably playing the trombone. And I remember asking Michael David if I could have a trombone teacher come, and every day at 4 o'clock the cast would go and learn the trombone. And he allowed that, and he paid for that. And I thought, look, it'll either work or it won't. You know, we'll know in a couple of weeks, you know. And as I would walk past the door every day, it sounded awful. It just sounded terrible. I thought, okay, this isn't going to work, because the trombone's actually harder to play than you think. And I thought, it's never going to work. And then, I have to say, in like that second week, I walked past that door, and I ended up being like those mothers in The Music Man, saying, oh, that's my kids. They're doing it. They're doing it. They're playing the trombone. And so what was amazing when they all came out on stage, it wasn't only that they were playing trombone, but they were so proud of themselves that they were playing the trombone. There's a great pride that came on the stage. And then the audience couldn't believe it. No one could believe that was happening. Because it was clear that it was real when they were playing.
Oh, yeah, I can remember the expressions on their faces, like, I can't believe I've been asked to do this, and I'm doing it, and yes. I'm so proud.
They were very proud.
Well, you talked about getting the idea of Contact in a nightclub, which, by the way, I just would have loved to have seen you dancing up a storm in a nightclub. But how else do you get your ideas or choose what you want to do? You're obviously an A-list director choreographer, so people are throwing things at you all the time. How do you decide, I'm going to do this one, I'm not going to do this one? What jumps
out? Well, I do, you're right, I do have to connect with the material in some way, either creating it myself with collaborators, with writers, or someone does approach me, but I do have to connect with it in some way, whether it's the music or the story, because I just don't feel I will be able to do any justice to material that I'm being forced to figure out. But whatever it is, I do a lot of research on the show, on the decade that it takes place in and the geographical area. You know, in Showboat, people dance differently in the North than they did in the South, you know. So you do take everything into consideration in the research. You know, in Bullets Over Broadway, a lot of the choreography was based on the architecture of the New York City in the 20s, you know. So the girls would hit positions of Art Deco lamps and those famous figurines that you would see on the sides of buildings, and that would be in the choreography. So the choreography was very motivated at the time. So in Scottsboro Boys, of course, it's based on a minstrel show, so a lot of the steps in there were pure vaudeville steps that the guys did. And that actually came from Kander and Ebb and I wanting to, and David Thompson, the writer, wanting to create something true or something real. A lot of times in the musical theater, you're you are in a fantastical world or a made-up world. And we got together because we just wanted to work together again and decided to wanted to do something real or based on a true story. So we started to do research on the great trials in America. And, of course, the Scottsboro Boys is right on that list. And we started to do research off of that. And it was filled with amazing characters, eccentric characters, and how that particular group of men, you know, changed the way juries were chosen now. I mean, it really changed history in a lot of ways. So we started to think of how we could do this show, and we worked with Canner Neb, you know, once a week for a long time, and they were on fire with it, you know, because Canner Neb, they write for the underdog, you know, maybe this time. They write for people who are the underdog and are trying to achieve something. So the idea to write about nine young men who were wrongly accused of a horrific crime, they couldn't wait to write it. They just sort of poured out of them. And so, and then sadly, we lost Freddie, and the show sat on a shelf for a long time. And then Candor called and said, what if we looked at this again? And I said, of course. And when we did look at it again, I realized how much had been written and how much had been finished. And so we took it down to the Vineyard, and they gave us a reading, and off we went, and we started to work on it again.
They said yes.
I know, they said yes. But it's interesting how shows come to be. That was something where Candor Neb and I wanted to work with each other, and that out of that just love of each other came the Scottsboro Boys. Something like Mel Brooks knocking on the door, wanting, you know, to take a screenplay and making it into a musical. And he knocked on the door with the screenplay. You know, nothing had been done. And but, of course, he knocked on the door and sang. He opened the door and he sang, that face, that fabulous face. And, you know, we sang all the way down the hallway. And he jumped up on a chair and looked down and said, hey, I'm Mel Brooks. Like that. And I thought, you know, well, whether this is not good, I don't know how this is going to go. But whatever it is going to be an adventure of a lifetime, you know. And Mel, you know, just, it was an amazing time with him. It was just amazing. He's an extraordinary man, and he's funny all the time, and he's become a good friend, too. So I'm quite fortunate to have these artists in my life that I have admired and now have become friends with. It's, you know, I have to pinch myself.
Well, I think they have to pinch themselves a little bit, too. Do you like getting involved very early with these projects? Like, what do you think a director's role is in the writing or creation process?
Well, certainly my role is from the beginning. I really start from scratch with most projects and develop them and work with the writers as much as possible on it. About 12 years ago, I decided not to do any more revivals, although I'm offered revivals quite a lot, but I just wanted to create for the theater. And I was fortunate to have done three big ones, Oklahoma and Showboat and The Music Man, and they're so American and iconic and learned a lot from them and their structure. But I really just wanted to only work on new pieces. So in doing so, you either come up with them yourself or someone hands you a screenplay. It comes in different ways, how shows are done and how shows are created for me.
Over the last couple of decades, have you noticed the audiences changing in their appetite for theater, for dance? How have you seen what they want change?
Well, I do think on Broadway the audiences have changed. I mean, there are many more tourists, and I think producers are gearing towards more tourist shows or shows that have an appeal I think that's why you see so many revivals now too. I think financially it's so costly to mount a show that I think producers would love to have a sure thing. Not like anyone would want to have a sure thing, but it's a little different now. People won't take chances like they used to. There's not enough chances on artists, I think. So it has changed.
You've worked, obviously, with some of the best and biggest producers in the business. How do you like to work with producers? What's that relationship like for you?
Oh, I like it a lot. Well, some producers, the thing is, you get your best work from anybody when there's respect. And respect in the room. And I really do respect producers who are taking a chance on the theater. I mean, right off the bat, I respect them, you know, and I do like to work with them, and I do like to hear what they're thinking and their opinions. I do, when there are a lot of producers, though, I always say at that first meeting that let's choose one person, and that's the person that gives me the notes. And I can hear from all of you, but I can only hear from that one person. And then that person will come and tell me, oh, I don't like the color of her lipstick or something like that. And fine, that's fine. And then the thing is, even if you do get notes from producers, even if something is off base or not you don't totally agree with, it certainly though heightens that area to make you maybe think of something else. If there's something that bothers somebody, even if you don't quite agree with it, it does put a little something around there that makes you think, oh, maybe there I could do this instead. So I don't mind at all hearing from people. But there is a way to do it, a diplomatic way, in a respectful way. So because in the end, you just want the room to feel safe. You want the room that you're working in to feel safe for the actors. And if a producer has gone so far as to be producing for the theater, you know, I think they do love those actors and they do love people.
Now, you've obviously had some pretty big, massive hits throughout your career, but not everyone can have a perfect record. But you didn't write these shows, right? So how, when a show doesn't work, do you take it personally? How do you deal with
that? Oh, it's very sad when a show doesn't work, because the thing is, you know, even... Because a show can be a financial flop, but that doesn't mean it was an artistic success for you. And I think that's how you have to think about these things. Each show I do is sort of a stepping stone to the next show. I carry what I've learned from that show on to the next show. And so when people refer to something as a flop, it doesn't really register with me. Financially, yes, and I do feel bad about that financially. But artistically, there's always good work. There's always great images to have seen. And there's always great performances to have seen. So, as Mel Brooks says, you hope for the best and expect the worst. But you do have to hope for the best. You have to hope that people love what you love. But I haven't done anything that I feel that I didn't put my whole heart into or I didn't put my whole soul into. Whether it takes to an audience is a different story. You know, and that's something, if we all knew what that formula was, we'd all be doing it. But you just never know, in the end, what's going to sell tickets.
Advice for young women in Delaware choreographing halftime shows that want to work on Broadway?
Well, I think, you know, the best advice I can give you is don't be afraid to ask the question, because the worst thing that can happen is somebody could say no, and then you go on. But if you believe in your work and believe in your talent, get up there and ask some questions. And also, you know, you have to stir it up yourself. You can't wait for somebody to call you. You can't wait for the phone to ring. You have to go out and create it. And if you really believe in your art, you have to go out and create it yourself.
Mel Brooks isn't going to knock on everybody's door and start singing a tune. Okay, my last question, which I ask all of my guests, okay? I want you to call my genie question.
Oh.
I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin knocks on the door to your very nice office here, which, by the way, you all can't see this, but her office could be a dance studio. It's incredible. And the genie says, Stro, you've done such amazing work, these iconic images in dance, and you've directed these massive hits and also these incredibly important shows like Scottsboro Boys. I want to grant you a wish. Only one wish. What's the one thing that drives you so crazy about Broadway that makes you, who are also one of the sweetest people I've ever met, angry, keeps you up at night, makes you so mad that you would want this genie to wish away with the snap of his finger? Just one thing.
Well, I think if it could be, it would be the big-headed creatures in Times Square. If the genie could wish the big-headed creatures to go to the big-headed island somewhere to, SpongeBob and all those folks, I'd rather them have proper jobs as ushers in a theater or something else rather than wearing big heads in Times Square.
I love it. Well, look, a lot of people ask me why I do this podcast, and I always tell people it's because I learned so much from doing it. I've learned so much from you today. Thank you so much for doing it. Thanks to all of you for listening, and tune in next week. We got someone else special coming up. Thanks.
Hey, it's Ken. I'm still listening to this Daddy Long Legs cast recording, so go get it today. You're going to love it. Promise.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.